Things were starting to smell just like the bathwater. The scone of stone had been stolen, had it? Now there was a coincidence. It had been a complete shot in the dark, but lately he was on the lucky side when it came to nocturnal targets. Someone had pinched the replica scone, and now the real one had gone missing, and someone in Ankh-Morpork who was good at making rubber moulds had been found dead. You didn't need the brains of detritus and a snowdrift to suspect a connection. A recollection nagged at him. Someone had said something, and he'd thought it odd at the time, but then something else had happened, and it had gone out of his mind. Something about a welcome to Bonk, only... Well, he was here, no doubt about that. Absolute confirmation of the fact was brought forth half an hour later at supper. Vimes cut into a sausage and stared. "What is in these, all this pink stuff?" he demanded. "That's meat, Your Grace," said Inigo, on the other side of the table. "Well, where's the texture? Where's the white bits and the yellow bits and those green bits you always hope are herbs?" "To a connoisseur here, Your Grace, an Ankh-Morpork sausage would not be considered a sausage."
"Oh, really? So what would he call it?"
A loaf, Your Grace, or possibly a log. Here, a butcher can be hanged if his sausages are not all meat. And at that, it must be from a named domesticated animal, and I perhaps should add that by named I do not mean that it should have been called Spot or Ginger. I'm sure that if Your Grace would prefer the more genuine Ankh-Morpork taste, Igor could make up some side dishes of stale bread and sawdust."
"Thank you for that patriotic comment," said Vimes. "However, these are okay, I suppose. They just came as a bit of a shock, that's all." "No."
He put his hand over his mug to prevent Igor from filling it with beer.
"Is there something wrong, Master?"
"Just water, please," said Vimes. "No beer."
"The Master does not drink beer?"
"No, and perhaps in a mug without a face on it." He took another look at the stein. "Why has it got a lid, by the way? Are you afraid of the rain getting in?"
"I've never been quite certain of that one," said Inigo, as Igor shuffled off. "From observation, though, I believe the purpose of the stein is to stop the beer being spilled while using the mug to conduct the singing."
"Ah, the old quaffing problem," said Vimes. "What a clever idea."
Sybil patted him on the knee.
"You're not in Ankh-Morpork any more, dear," she said.
"Now we're alone, Your Grace," said Inigo, leaning closer. "I'm very worried about Mr. Sleeps, the acting consul, you remember? He seems to have vanished. Some of his personal items have gone, too."
"Holiday?"
"Not at a time like this, sir, and—" There was a thud of wood against wood as Igor re-entered, pointedly carrying a stepladder. Inigo sat back. Vimes found that he was yawning.
"We'd better talk about that in the morning," he said, as the ladder was dragged towards the horrible hunting trophies. "It's been a long day, what with one thing and another."
"Of course, Your Grace."
The bed's mattress was so soft that Vimes sank into it nervously, afraid it might close over the top of his head. That was just as well, because the pillow was... Well, everyone knew a pillow was a sack full of feathers, didn't they? Not an apprentice eiderdown like this thing.
"Just fold it up, Sam," said Sybil from the depths of the mattress. "Good night."
"Good night."
"Sam!"
There was a snore from Sam Vimes. Sybil sighed and turned over. Vimes awoke a few times to the sound of thuds from downstairs.
"Snow leopards," he muttered, and drifted away. There was a louder crash.
"Moose,"
murmured Lady Sybil.
"Elk,"
mumbled Vimes.
"No, definitely moose."
Sometime later there was a muffled scream, a thud, and a sound very much like the sound made when a huge wooden ruler is held against a desk and twanged.
"Swordfish," said Sam and Sybil together, and went back to sleep.
"You should present your credentials to the rulers of Bjunk," said Inigo in the morning. Vimes was looking out of the window. Two guards in the rainbow-coloured uniforms were standing stiffly to attention outside the embassy.
"What are they doing here?" he said.
"Guarding," said Inigo.
"Guarding who from what?"
"Just generally guarding. I suppose it's thought that guards give such a finished look to an important building."
What was that you said about credentials?
They're just formal letters from Lord Vetinari, confirming your appointment. The law is a little complex, but at the moment the order of precedence is the future Low King, the Lady Margolotta, and the Baron von Überwald. Each, of course, will pretend that you are not calling on the other two. It's called the arrangement. It's an awkward system, but it keeps the peace.
If I understood your briefing, said Vimes, still watching the guards, in the days of Imperial Überwald, the whole bloody show was run by the werewolves and the vampires, and everyone else was lunch.
Somewhat simplistic but broadly true, said Inigo, brushing some dust off Vimes's shoulder.
And then it all broke up, and the dwarfs became powerful, because there's dwarfs from one end of Überwald to the other, and they all keep in touch.
The system certainly survives political upheaval, yes.
And then, what was it, a diet of beetles?
The diet of bugs. Diet being an Überwaldian word for meeting, and bugs being an important town further upriver, famous for its pastries made from flax. Everyone came to an arrangement. No one would wage war on any of the others, and everyone could live in peace. No garlic to be grown, no silver to be mined. And the werewolves and vampires promised that those things wouldn't be needed.
Seems a bit trusting, said Vimes.
It appears to have worked.
What did the humans think about it all?
Well, humans have always been a bit of background noise in the history of Überwald, Your Grace.
Must be a bit dull for the undead, though.
No, the bright ones know the old days can't come back.
Ah, well, that's always the trick, isn't it, finding the bright ones? Vimes put on his helmet. And what are the dwarfs like?
The future Low King is considered pretty clever, Your Grace.
How does he stand on Ankh-Morpork?
He can take Ankh-Morpork or leave it alone, Your Grace. On balance, I believe he doesn't much like us.
I thought it was Albrecht who didn't like us.
No, Your Grace. Albrecht is the one who would be happy to see Ankh-Morpork burned to the ground. Rhys merely wishes we didn't exist.
I thought he was one of the good guys.
Your Grace, I did hear you express some negative sentiments about Ankh-Morpork on the way here.
Yeah, but I live there. I'm allowed to. That's patriotic.
Across the whole of the world, Your Grace, there inexplicably appear to be definitions of good guy, which do not automatically mean likes Ankh-Morpork. You will find out, I dare say. The other two are a lot easier to deal with. It may have been the Lady Margolotta who tried the little trick with the guards last night. She was the one who got me to bring you back, anyway. She has invited you for drinks.
Oh.
She's a vampire.
What?
Inigo sighed. Your Grace, I thought you understood. Vampires are simply part of Überwald. That is where they belong. I'm afraid this is something you will have to come to terms with. I understand that now they obtain blood by arrangement. Some people are impressed by a title, Your Grace.
Good. Grief.
Quite so. In any case, you will be safe. Remember your diplomatic immunity.
I didn't quite see that working in the Willingness Pass the other day.
No. They were common bandits.
Really? Has your man Sleeps turned up? Haven't you taken this to the watch here?
There's no watch here, as you understand the term. You saw them. They're gate guards, enforcers for the city rulers, not officers of the law, but inquiries are being made.
Does Sybil come with me for this bit? Said Vimes, and thought, we were guards like that, not so long ago.
It is usually done by the new ambassador and his guards.
Well, Detritus is staying here to keep an eye on her, all right? She said this morning she really thinks the place would be better for some decent carpet, and there's no stopping her when she's in a tape-measure mood. I'll take Cheery and one of the lads from outside for the look of the thing. I assume you're coming.
I won't be required, sir. The new coachman knows the way. Morporkian is the diplomatic language after all, and I should be making inquiries.
Delicate ones?
Indeed, Your Grace.
If he's been killed, won't that be an act of war?
Yes and no, Your Grace.
What? Sleeps was, is our man. Inigo looked awkward.
It would depend on exactly where he was and what he was doing.
Vimes gave him a blank look, and then the penny dropped and operated his brain.
Spying? Acquiring information. Everyone does it.
Yeah, but if you find a diplomat going too far, you just send him home with a sharp note, don't you?
Around the circle, see, Your Grace, that is the case. Here they may have a different approach.
Something rather sharper than a note?
Exactly.
One of the guards was Captain Tantony. There was some minor difficulty, but the argument that, since he was guarding Vimes, he might as well be where Vimes was, eventually carried some weight. Tantony had the look of an agonizingly logical man. He kept giving Vimes curious looks as the coach rattled out of the town. Beside him sat Cheery, with her legs dangling. Vimes noticed, although it was not the kind of thing he generally made a habit of noticing, that the shape of her breastplate had been subtly altered, probably by the same armourer that Angua went to indicate that the chest underneath it was not quite the same shape of chest that you got under the armour of, say, Corporal Nobbs. Although, of course, probably no one had a chest the same shape as that of Corporal Nobbs. She was wearing her high-heeled iron boots, too.
"Look, you don't have to come," he said out loud.
"Yes, I do. I mean, I could go and get detritus instead, although I suppose there'd be even more upshot if I took a troll into a dwarf mine. I mean, rather than a
"Girl," said Cheery, helpfully.
"Yes." Vimes felt the coach slow to a halt, even though they hadn't left the town yet, and he looked out. In front of them, across a small square, was a fort of sorts, but with much larger gates than you'd expect for its size. As Vimes stared at them, they were swung open from within. Inside was a slope. All the fort consisted of were four walls around a large, sloping tunnel.
"The dwarfs live underneath the town," he said,
as the light from outside was gradually replaced by the infrequent glow of torches. But they clearly showed the coach was rattling past a long, long line of stationary carts. The pools of light revealed horses and drivers talking in groups.
"Under quite a lot of Uberwald," said Cheery. "This is just the nearest entrance, sir. We'll probably have to stop in a minute because the horses don't like—"
"Ah." The coach stopped again, and the coachman banged on the side to indicate that this was the end of the line. The queue of carts wound off down another tunnel, but the coach had stopped in a small cave with a big door. A couple of dwarfs were waiting there. They had axes slung across their backs, although by dwarf standards this counted merely as politely dressed rather than heavily armed. Their attitude, however, was in the international language of people guarding gates everywhere.
"Commander Sam Vimes, Ankh-Morpork Si—" "Ambassador from Ankh-Morpork," said Vimes, handing one of them his papers.
At least it was not hard to assume a lofty air with dwarfs. To his surprise, the document was read thoroughly, one dwarf looking over the other one's shoulder and pointing out interesting subclauses. The official seal was carefully examined. One guard pointed to Cheery.
"Crack!
"My official guard," said Vimes. "Included in associated members of staff on page 2, he added helpfully.
"Must search thy coach," said the guard.
"No. Diplomatic immunity," said Vimes. "Tell 'em, Cheery." They listened to Cheery's urgent dwarfish. Then the other guard, whose face had indicated that there was something on his mind and it was jumping up and down, nudged his companion and pulled him aside. There was a torrent of whispers. Vimes couldn't understand, but he caught the word "williness," and shortly afterwards the word "hergrag," dwarfish for 30.
"Oh, gods," he said. "And a dog?"
"Good guess, sir," said Cheery.
The document was handed back hurriedly. Vimes could read the body language, even written smaller than usual. There was probably an expensive problem here, so the guards were inclined to leave it to someone who earned more money than them. One of them pulled a bell rope by the door. After some time, the door slid open, revealing a small room.
"We have to go in, sir," said Cheery.
"But there's no other doors."
"It's all right, sir."
Vimes stepped inside. The dwarves slid the door back, leaving them in the room, which was lit by a single candle.
"Some kind of waiting room," said Vimes.
Somewhere far off, something went clonk. The floor trembled for a moment, and then Vimes had an uneasy sensation of movement.
"The room moves," he said.
"Yes, sir. Several hundred feet down, probably. I think it's all done by counterweights.
They stood silently, unsure of what to say, as walls around them creaked and groaned. Then there was a rattle, a passing sensation of weight, and the room stopped moving.
"Wherever we're headed, keep your ears open," said Vimes. "Something's going on, I can feel it."
The door slid back. Vimes looked out onto the night sky underground. The stars were all around him, below him.
"I think we went down too far," he said,
and then his brain made sense of what his eyes had seen. The moving room had brought them out somewhere on the side of a huge cave. He was looking at 1,000 points of candlelight, spread out on the cavern floor and in other galleries. Now that he could grasp the scale of things, he realized that many of them were moving. The air was full of one huge sound, made up of thousands of voices echoed and re-echoed. Occasionally, a shout or a laugh would stand out, but mostly it was just an endless sea of sound beating on the shores of the eardrum.
"I thought you people lived in little mines," said Vimes.
"Well, I thought humans lived in little cottages, sir," said Cheery,
taking a candle from a large rack beside the door and lighting it.
"And then I saw Ankh-Morpork."
There was something recognizable about the way the lights were moving. A whole constellation of them was heading in towards one invisible wall, where reflected light now indicated very faintly the mouth of a large tunnel. In front of it was a row of lights. Think of it as a lot of people heading for something that one row of people was guarding.
"People down here aren't happy," said Vimes. "That looks like a mob to me. Look, you can tell by the way they move."
"Commander Vimes!"
He turned. In the gloom he could make out several dwarfs, each with a candle fixed to his helmet. In front of them was, presumably, another dwarf. He'd seen dwarfs like this in Ankh-Morpork, but always scurrying away. This was a deep-down dwarf. The robe it was wearing was made of overlapping leather plates. Instead of the small round iron helmet which Vimes had always thought dwarfs were born with, it had a pointed leather hat with more leather flaps all around it. The one at the front had been tied up to allow the wearer to look out at the world, or at least that part of it that was underground. The general effect was of a mobile cone.
That's me. Welcome to Schmelzberg, Your Excellency. I am the King's Jarahakhaga, which in your language you would call..."
But Vimes's lips had been moving fast as he tried to translate.
"Ideas taster," he said.
"Huh? That would be a way of putting it, yes. My name is Dee. Would you care to follow me? This should not take long."
The figure swept away. One of the other dwarfs prodded Vimes very gently, indicating that he should follow. The sound from far below redoubled. Someone was yelling.
"Is there a problem?" said Vimes, catching up with the fast-moving Dee. "We have no problems."
"Ah, he's already lied to me," thought Vimes. "We're being diplomatic." Vimes trailed after the dwarf through more caves, or tunnels. It was hard to tell, because in the darkness Vimes could only rely on a sense of the space around him. Occasionally they passed a lighted entrance to another cave or tunnel. Several guards, with candles on their helmets, stood at each one. The well-honed copper's radar was beeping at him continuously. Something bad was going on. He could smell the tension, the sense of quiet panic. The air was thick with it. Occasionally, other dwarfs scuttled past, distracted on some mission. Something very bad. People didn't know what to do next, so they were trying to do everything. And in the middle of this, important officers had to stop what they were doing because some idiot from some distant city had to hand over a piece of paper. Eventually, a door opened in the darkness. It led into a large, roughly oblong cave that, with its book-lined walls and paper-strewn tables, had the look of an office about it.
"Do be seated, Commander."
A match burst into life. One candle was lit, all lost and alone in the dark.
"We do try to make guests feel welcome," said Dee, scuttling behind his desk.
He pulled off his pointed hat and, to Vimes's amazement, put on a pair of thick smoked glasses.
"You had papers," he said.
Vimes handed them over.
"It says here, His Grace,"
the dwarf said after reading them for a while.
"Yep, that's me."
"And there's a sir."
"That's me too."
"And an excellency."
"'Fraid so."
Vimes narrowed his eyes.
I was blackboard monitor for a while, too.
There was a sound of angry voices from behind a door at the far end of the room.
What does a blackboard monitor do?
Said D, raising his voice.
What? I had to clean the blackboard after lessons.
The dwarf nodded. The voices grew louder, more intense. Dwarfish was such a good language to be annoyed in.
Erasing the teachings when they were learned, said D, shouting to be heard. Yes. A task given only to the trustworthy.
Could be, yes.
D folded up the letter and handed it back, glancing briefly at Cheery.
Well, these seem to be in order, he said. Would you care for a drink before you go?
Sorry, I thought I had to present myself to your king.
The swearing from the other side of the door was threatening to burn through the woodwork.
Oh, that won't be necessary, said D. At the moment, he should not be bothered with...
Trivial matters, said Vimes. I thought it was how the thing ought to be done. I thought dwarfs always did the thing that ought to be done.
At the moment, it would not be advisable, said D, raising his voice again over the noise. I'm sure you understand.
Let's assume I'm very stupid, said Vimes.
I assure you, Your Excellency, that what I see the King sees, and what I hear the King hears.
That's certainly true at the moment, isn't it?
D drummed his fingers on his desk.
Your Excellency, I have spent only long enough in your city to gain a general insight into your ways, but I might feel you are making fun of me.
May I speak freely?
From what I have heard of you, Your Monitorship, you usually do.
Have you found the Scone of Stone yet?
The expression on Dee's face told Vimes that he had scored, and that, almost certainly, the next thing the dwarf said would be another lie.
What a strange and untruthful thing to say! There is no possibility that the scone could have been stolen. This has been firmly declared. This is not a lie we would wish to hear repeated.
You told me I...
Vimes tried. By the sound of it, there was a fight going on behind the door now.
The scone will be seen by all at the coronation. This is not a matter for Ankh-Morpork or anyone else. I protest at this intrusion into our private affairs.
I merely... Nor do we have to show the scone to any prying troublemaker. It is a sacred trust and well guarded.
Vimes kept silent. Dee was better than Dunnet Duncan.
Every person leaving the scone cave is carefully watched. The scone cannot be removed. It is perfectly safe.
Dee was shouting now.
Ah, I understand, said Vimes quietly.
Good. So, you haven't found it yet, then?
Dee opened his mouth, shut it again, and then slumped back in his seat.
I think, Your Grace, that you had better...
The door at the other end of the room rolled back. Another dwarf, cone-shaped in his robes, stamped out, stopped, glared around him, went back through the door again, shouted some afterthoughts to whoever was beyond, and then made to head out of the room. He was brought up short when he almost walked into Vimes. The dwarf tilted its head to look up at him. There was no real face there, just a suggestion of the glint of angry eyes between the leather flaps.
Aranak Morpork!
Yes?
Vimes didn't understand the words that followed, but the nasty tone was unmistakable. The important thing was to keep smiling. That was the diplomatic way.
Why, thank you, he said. And may I say it...
There was a grunt from the dwarf. He'd seen Cheery.
Ha-ak!
He shouted. Vimes heard a gasp. There were other dwarfs clustered around the doorway. Then he glanced down at Cheery. Her eyes were shut. She was trembling.
"Who is this dwarf?" he said to Dee.
"This is Albrecht Albrechtsen," said the ideas taster.
"The runner-up?"
"Yes," said Dee, hoarsely.
"Then can you tell the creature that if he uses that word again in the presence of myself or any of my staff, there will be, as we diplomats say, repercussions? Wrap that up in diplomacy and give it to him, will you?"
The corners of Vimes's ears picked up a suggestion that not every dwarf listening was ignorant of the language. A couple of dwarfs were already heading purposefully towards them. Dee babbled a stream of hysterical dwarfish, just as the other dwarfs caught up with the gaping Albrecht and led him quietly but firmly away, but not before one of them had whispered something to the ideas taster.
The king wishes to see you, he mumbled.
Vimes looked towards the doorway. More dwarfs were hurrying through it now. Some of them were dressed in what Vimes thought of as normal dwarf clothing, others in the heavy black leathers of the deep-down clans. All of them glared at him as they went past. Then there was just empty floor all the way to the door.
"Do you come too?" he said.
"Not unless he asks for me," said Dee. "I wish you luck, your monitorship."
Beyond the door was a room of bookshelves, stretching up, stretching away. Here and there a candle merely changed the density of the darkness. There were lots of them, though, punctuating the distance. Vimes wondered how big this room must be.
"In here is a record of every marriage, every birth, every death, every movement of a dwarf from one mine to another, the succession of the king of each mine, every dwarf's progress through Kazakra, mining claims, the history of famous axes, and other matters of note," said a voice behind him. "And perhaps most importantly, every decision made under dwarf law for 1500 years is written down in this room, look you."
Vimes turned. A dwarf, short even by dwarf standards, was standing behind him. He seemed to be expecting a reply.
Every decision?
Oh, yes.
Were they all good? Said Vimes.
The important thing is that they were all made, said the king.
Thank you, young dwarf. You may straighten up.
Cheery was bowing.
Sorry, should I be doing that? Said Vimes. You're not the king, are you?
Not yet.
I'm sorry, I was expecting someone more,
Do go on.
Someone more kingly.
The low king sighed.
I mean, you look just like an ordinary dwarf, said Vimes, weakly.
This time the king smiled. He was slightly shorter than average for dwarfs, and dressed in the usual almost uniform of leather and home-forged chain mail. He looked old, but dwarfs started looking old around the age of 5 years, and were still looking old 300 years later. And he had that musical cadence to his speech that Vimes associated with Chlamydos. If he'd asked Vimes to pass the ketchup in Gimlet's Whole Food Delicatessen, Vimes wouldn't have given him a second look.
"This diplomacy business," said the king. "Are you getting the hang of it, do you think?"
"It doesn't come easy, I must admit, Your Majesty.
I believe you have been until now a watchman in Ankh-Morpork."
Yes.
"And you had a famous ancestor, I believe, who was a regicide."
"Here it comes," thought Vimes.
"Yes, stone-faced Vimes," he said, as levelly as possible.
"I've always thought that that was a bit unfair, though. It was only one king. It wasn't as if it was a hobby."
"But you don't like kings," said the dwarf.
"I don't meet many, sir," said Vimes, hoping that this would pass for a diplomatic answer. It seemed to satisfy the king.
"I went to Ankh-Morpork once when I was a young dwarf," he said, walking towards a long table piled high with scrolls.
Really?
"Lord Ornament, they called me, and what was it? Ah, yes, Short Ass. Some children threw stones at me."
"I'm sorry."
"I expect you'll tell me that sort of thing doesn't happen anymore."
"It doesn't happen as much, but you always get idiots who don't move with the times."
The king gave Vimes a piercing glance.
"Indeed, the times. But now they're always Ankh-Morpork's times, see?"
"I'm sorry?"
"When people say, 'We must move with the times,' they really mean, 'You must do it my way.' And there are some who would say that Ankh-Morpork is a kind of vampire. It bites, and what it bites turns into copies of itself. It sucks, too. It seems all our best go to Ankh-Morpork, where they live in squalor. You leave us dry."
Vimes was at a loss. It was clear that the little figure now sitting at the long table was a lot brighter than he was, although right now he felt as dim as a penny candle in any case. It was also clear that the king hadn't slept for quite some time. He decided to go for honesty.
"Can't really answer that, sir,"
he said, adopting a variant on his talking to veterinary approach. "But..."
"Yes?"
"I'd wonder, you know, if I was king, I'd wonder why people were happier living in squalor in Ankh-Morpork than staying back home, sir."
"Ah, you're telling me how I should think now?"
No, sir, just how I think. There's dwarf bars all over Ankh-Morpork, and they've got mining tools wired to the wall, and there's dwarfs in them every night quaffing beer and singing sad songs about how they wish they were back in the mountains digging for gold. But if you said to them, "Fine, the gate's open, off you go, send us a postcard," they'd say, "Oh, well, yeah, I'd love to, but we've just got the new workshop finished. Maybe next year we'll go to Oberwald."
"They come to the mountains to die," said the king.
"They live in Ankh-Morpork."
"Why is this, do you think?"
"I couldn't say. Because no one tells them how to, I suppose."
"And now you want our gold and iron," said the king. "Is there nothing we can keep?"
"I don't know about that either, sir. I wasn't trained for this job."
The king muttered something under his breath, then, much louder, he said, "I can offer you no favours, Your Excellency. These are difficult times, see?"
"But my real job is finding things out," said Vimes. "If there is anything I could do to—"
The king thrust the papers at Vimes.
"Your letters of accreditation, Your Excellency. Their contents have been noted."
"And that shuts me up," Vimes thought.
"I would ask you one thing, though," the king went on.
"Yes, sir?"
"Really, 30 men and a dog?"
"No, there were only 7 men. I killed one of them because I had to."
"How did the others die?"
Victims of circumstance, sir."
"Well, then, your secret is safe with me. Good morning, Miss Littlebottom."
Cheery looked stunned. The king gave her a brief smile.
"Ah, the rights of the individual. A famous Ankh-Morpork invention, or so they say. Thank you, Dee. His Excellency was just leaving. You may send in the Copperhead delegation."